Okay, now we arrived in another moment that always we are waiting for, and so I want to welcome Mr. and Mrs. Vera Nahjavani here. Thank you so much.
I promise you I won't mention epoch. You know, last year I told you some stories about the life of our beloved Anatol Bahar Ruhi Khanum. There are many stories in her life that I can still tell you. But I thought maybe this year I'll go to the lives of some of our heroes, some of the Baha'is who stood up alone at their time and faced a whole world, a whole family, and a whole world of non-believers, non-Baha'is. How they did it? Who were they? You know, this heroic age, I'm not talking about epoch, just heroic age. The heroic age is just full of these heroes of our faith. We know we are more familiar with the ones that the beloved guardian mentions in God Passes By and in the Nabil's narrative. These wonderful human beings who were courageous, who were saintly, who were heroic, who went forward, and they gave their lives. And Shoghi Effendi told us that they are our spiritual ancestors. It's all of us, not just the Persians. The spiritual ancestors of the Baha'is in the East and the West. Now, apart from them, we also have spiritual ancestors right here in this continent of Europe that you live in. I want to talk tonight about one of these heroic human beings and the life that she led and what made her what she became. You know, the the divine plans of Abdu'l-Bahá, 16 tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá addressed, 14 of it to the United States and 2 to Canada, have something in common, all of them, which is so wonderful. We read prayers about teaching. Most of these prayers that is revealed by Abdu'l-Bahá about teaching comes at the end of each one of these tablets. The one I love very much, part of it, I'm just going to read to you. How can I succeed unless thou assist me to triumph by the host of thy confirmation, which alone can change a gnat into an eagle, a drop of water into rivers and seas, and an atom into lights and suns. We have this example of atoms and drops and gnats in several prayers of Abdu'l-Bahá. In another word, he is telling us, assuring us, that a gnat can become an eagle, a drop can become an ocean. And we have the example of these drops in our own history. And one of the examples was Mae Maxwell. Mae Maxwell was the mother of Anatol Bahar Ruhi Khanum. But I don't think it is really very fair to introduce her just as the mother of Anatol Bahar Ruhi Khanum, because she was herself a person, that was outstanding beyond measures. Ruhi Khanum often spoke about this. She said Shoghi Effendi told her, "One of the reasons I chose you to be my wife was because you are the daughter of May Maxwell." This was the station of May Maxwell. Now, to look at her life, who was she? Where was she? Was she something brilliant from the birth and brilliant in her education and brilliant in her services to humanity? No. She was a very ordinary person. She was born in a middle class, upper middle class, in New York, in New Jersey. The family were well enough, well-to-do. The grandfather was a banker, so was very well-to-do, but his bank was burglarized, and he lost everything, and the whole family lost the money, and they lived middle-class people. She was born in the heroic age. She was born in the year 1870. It was a period that women really were always the last to get any special attention in the family. They were two children. She was the older. The brother was the younger. So every bit of money and encouragement in the family went to the education of the brother. And the interesting thing is that the girl, the sister, was so proud of her brother. She prided herself with his achievements. It was not soured her or anything like that. She was a kind of a dreamer as a child. She had all kinds of visions and dreams, and she wrote poetry, and she was a very sensitive, sweet young girl. When she was 6 years old, her mother took the two children and the grandmother. The grandfather had just died, so the grandmother, the mother, and these two young children, 4 and 6, they came to Paris. So her first language that she learned really in school was French, and she spoke beautiful French. But as I say, she was always in the background. When she was 14, 15, she went to England. She had a very dear cousin, her mother was the sister of her own mother, aunt, and this mother had just died. And so the father of this girl invited May to go and be with her daughter because her daughter was heartbroken. And this was her first touch with British Isles. She stayed there 1 year, and she had many wonderful experiences. As I say, she used to dream and have visions and so on. And then she returned, and they went back to the United States. And later on, again, they came to France when her brother was studying architecture. Now, during this period, something happened to May. When she was about 19, 20, nobody knows. She was struck by some kind of illness that Abdu'l-Bahá later on said to one of the believers, that May Bowles was struck by a disease that no one knew the cause of it. Had she not found the faith, she would have died of it. It was a mixture of physical, nervous kind of illness combined with a spiritual quest. During this period between her 20 until 30, she had this deep desire and the feeling that the truth has come to the world. She must find it. And she would, as much as she was able, she would study everything. At one time, she wanted to become a nun, and she studied Catholicism, and then she discovered that it did not satisfy her. She went to Theosophy, and she went to all kinds of... You see, this was a period of many, many people in the world were in this quest of finding the truth. The return of Christ was something in the air. They were all waiting for it, and she was one of them. So, as the result of not finding, she became very ill. And for 1 year, she was in bed in such a state that she could not walk, she could not do much. And it was at this period that the first group of the Baha'is came to Paris. Mrs. Hurst, who was the mother of the millionaire and the wife of another millionaire, and she had heard the name of Abdu'l-Bahá and about the faith, and she was going on a cruise with her own family. She decided to include Akka in her program and go and see Abdu'l-Bahá. And she was a very close friend of the mother of Mae Maxwell. And so in Paris, she came to the home of the Bowles, and when she heard that this daughter, young daughter, was very ill, she said, "I have in my company a doctor, a very good doctor. I'll send my doctor to see your daughter." "3 years." And when she went and saw May, when he saw May, he said to her, "You know, I cannot do much for you, but I think my wife can." And it was Louis Getzinger who told May about Abdu'l-Bahá. And it's very fascinating to know how. She didn't talk about anything, you know, except she said, "You know, your answer is in the hand of a prisoner who holds the key to peace." And May had no idea who this prisoner was, key to what peace. But when she heard this, she said, I believe, and she fainted. And that's how she accepted the faith, without knowing anything else. Slowly, Lua Getzinger, as much as she knew, she gave her. And then, because she wanted to see Abdu'l-Bahá, Mrs. Hertz invited her to be in her party and took her to Abdu'l-Bahá. Now, the story of her pilgrimage is really the story of her transformation. You know, when Abdu'l-Bahá said in this prayer that a gnat can become an eagle, I think with some human beings, it's a slow process. You gradually come out of being a mosquito and you become maybe a little bird, and eventually you become an eagle. With some believers, it was an instantaneous change in their lives. It was instantly they were transformed. And Mae Maxwell was one of them. She went to Haifa. She met Abdu'l-Bahá. Without knowing very much, she just gave her heart and her soul to Abdu'l-Bahá for the rest of her life. And it's very interesting. When she came back from the pilgrimage, her mother was not a believer. She was a very worldly, she was a very wonderful woman, very open-minded, but very worldly woman. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote this tablet to the mother of Mae Maxwell. He said, this is in 1902. He said, "Thy Lord shall strengthen thee May herself. Said, "Thy Lord shall strengthen thee in a matter whereby the queens of the world will envy thy happy state. Throughout all times and ages, because verily the love of God is as a glorious crown upon thy head, the brilliant jewels of which are glittering forth unto all horizons. Its brilliancy, transparency, and effulgence shall appear in future centuries, when the signs of God will be spread and the word of God will encompass the heart of all the people of the world." I want to find the one to the mother because it's really very interesting. Because to her he said that your daughter came, She was a mundane and she became heavenly. She was of this world, now she is of the next. She is of the world of kingdom. You see this instant transformation. She was just a human being when, and she came back home something else. She came back from her pilgrimage. Her pilgrimage is, you should read this story because she has written it herself in a small booklet called Early Pilgrimage. And it is so heartwarming when you read her, how she gave her heart to Abu Baha, what happened during this pilgrimage. For example, she speaks of one thing very fascinating. She said, "One night I was upset and I told Lua, one of the pilgrims that was with them, she was not very happy with him. So she spoke about something this person had done, which was not very kind. But she just expressed her feeling about it. Abdul Baha arrived very soon after that. He called Lua. Now Abdul Baha wasn't in the room. Nobody had gone to report it to him. He called Lua and he said, 'I am unhappy because somebody tonight spoke unkindly about another person.' This was told in private to Lua. At dinner time, May was sitting in front of Abu Baha and she felt that there was something. Abu Baha looked at her not with very happy eyes. And she didn't know what she has done, but she knew Abu Baha was not happy, and she burst into tears. And all through dinner she cried. Nobody paid any attention to her, including Abu Baha. She cried, and at the end Abu Baha looked and smiled at her and encouraged her, and it was finished. And she came out, and in her life, according to the testimony of her daughter Ruhi Khanum, she said, 'I never heard my mother ever speak unkindly about anybody. If she had anything to say to somebody, she was straightforward, she was very frank. If they had done something wrong, he would tell them in person.' And the way she said it, people took it from her and it was fine. But this was this method of transforming this woman. She went back. This pilgrimage was in 1898-99. Abdul Baha gave her really a mission in France. And when I say that May was the spiritual ancestor of Europe, is because it's very interesting how through this little group and the very core of it, this May Bowles, the cause of Baha'u'llah within 1 year went to France, they went to England through Thomas Breakwell, it went to Italy through Juliet Thompson, who had just come to go and study painting and heard from somebody that there is this young woman in Paris who knows something about the new religion, and she was besides herself and came all the way to Paris to see May Bowles, and she became a believer. And this, from this little group, this cause of Baha'u'llah in a mysterious way went out in Europe. So to me, she is your spiritual ancestor, a personalized spiritual ancestor. She was all alone in Paris. Her mother was, she had an open heart, a house, and she allowed her to invite people. There was daily teaching work going on. At this time, Abu Baha sent Mirza Abul Fazl, who was the greatest scholar of the faith, to Paris with a translator to train these new Baha'is. So May's mother was very fond of Mirza Abul Fazl, and so he was coming. Now, the time has come that Abu Baha suddenly sent a cable to May Maxwell, May Bowles, telling her, don't leave Paris. The mother was very surprised. She had written herself a letter to Abdu'l-Bahá to say that now this is the last year that we have been in Paris for, 8 years, 10 years. Now we are going back to America, and I want to take my children on vacation to the seaside, so please know that we are going. And what did Abdu'l-Bahá do? He sent a cable not to the mother, but to the daughter, and said, don't leave Paris under any circumstances. The mother was absolutely besides herself. She said, what is happening? Who is this man, Oriental man, in a Turkish prison, who is telling my daughter what to do? Who is interfering with the plans of our lives? She was so upset that she went to Mirza Abul Fazl and told this and said, do something. I don't like, what I see. Mirza Abul Fazl, just to calm the lady down, wrote a letter to Abdu'l-Bahá and told him, this is the situation. And Abdu'l-Bahá sent another cable, which is really, it's unbelievable. In this cable, Abdu'l-Bahá said, all right, if she wants to go, she can go for one day. So the day came when the mother and the brother were leaving for their vacation, and May refused to go. And she, in this little booklet, in an article she has written, she describes her sorrow when she took her mother and her brother to the train station. And she said, I stood and I saw these two faces which were dearest to my heart, that all through my life they have been my friends and my mentor. I saw how sad and grieved my mother was, how angry she was, and I saw my brother. There was no feeling of love in his face. They left, and she was all alone, and her mother had locked their apartment, said, I'm going away. Go to your friends, your Baha'i friends. I'm sure they'll help you. That night, she talks in this story that she has written. She said, that night, I went to a small pension. I took a room, and I cried the whole night, and I prayed that God may give me strength. And the next day, she went to their regular weekly meeting at the home of Mrs. Jackson. And Mrs. Jackson heard the story, said, come, I have a small apartment in my house, you come and stay with us. So she moved to the home of Mrs. Jackson. She doesn't know why Abdu'l-Bahá asked her to stay. This is the measure of her face. She has no idea why is it that Abdu'l-Bahá is doing this to her. So she went and stayed there for a whole month. Waiting, she knew something must be happening. During this month, two things happened, which were significant. One was that one day, one of the Baha'is, you see, most of these new Baha'is, within 1.5 years, Paris had about 30 Baha'is. It's a very fabulous thing. I wish Paris would do again something like that. Within 1.5 years from this one woman, they became a community of 30 people. Most of them were Americans. Americans who were studying in Paris or doing special things. So they had regular meetings in the home of Mrs. Jackson. And so the next day she went to this meeting and she stayed there. And every day people would come, inquirers would come. And one of the new Baha'is was Edith Sanderson. And she was very close friend with this Frenchman, Hippolyte. And one day Hippolyte came to the house of May and he said, look, I have no religion, I don't believe in God. But I want to know, what have you told Edith? You have changed her completely. She was a woman who was always very sad and always looking at the dark side of life. And since she has come to you and since she has adopted this new religion, she's changed. She's very happy. She's very hopeful. What did you tell her? Tell me. So May told the story of the face and who Abdul Baha was. Hippolyte Dreyfus was a scientist and he was an agnostic. And he listened and he said, well, good ideas, but I don't believe it. I don't believe it's this. And as he was leaving, he said, can I come again? So May gave whatever she had in writing in those days, were very little, gave it to him and he went. 10 days later, he came back. And he came back and he came back. And he became the first French Baha'i. But this wasn't what Abu Baha wished for May to stay. It was towards the end of the month when one day this American woman that she had met before, she had no interest in the face or anything, came to her house, knocked at her door, and she opened. And with her was this young man. And she describes the beauty of this young man. Very slim, very delicate features, very thoughtful. And this American friend, she invited them in, and the American friend said to her that, you know, we came from the United States on the same boat, and this young man has ideas that I told him you are interested in. He's, I don't know, a theosophist or something, and I have brought here for him to talk with you. May describes the features of this young man, who was Thomas Breakwell. He says, as I looked at him, I saw that there was a veil in front of his eyes. I didn't know what this veil was. But there was a thirst in him. So she invited them in and she spoke. She said they stayed for some time and she never mentioned the faith. She never mentioned Abdul Baha. They spoke about spiritual matters, about theosophy, about everything. And she said she felt that the eyes of Thomas Breakwell was constantly on her, as if he was trying to go into her soul, into her heart. But he never asked anything. And when he was leaving, all he said to May was, may I come again? She said, yes, of course. And he left. And the next morning, very early, early in the morning, there was a knock at her door. Mrs. Maxwell was an early riser. She was up. Ruhi Khanum used to say she had heard from Abdul Baha a word on her pilgrimage that stayed with her all through her life. Abdul Baha had told her something like this, that the spiritual sustenance is given to man at the hour of dawn. So there she was. Every dawn she was up to receive her spiritual sustenance. So it was at one of these dawns that morning when there was a knock at the door, and when she opened, it was Thomas Breakwell standing outside her door. Said, the moment I looked at him, I saw that the veil had been removed. Something had happened to him. He was disheveled. He came in. He said, I have not slept. I have walked all night. Said, when I left you, I decided to walk. Now, the day before when she had come, she had told May all his plans. He said, I have come to Europe. I want to be in Europe for 2-3 months. I want to travel. I want to see Europe. And I'll go back to my work in the United States. Now, this morning he came and he said, tell me, what is it? And they said, what are you asking? He said, when I was walking, said, yesterday, when I left you last night, I walked in Champs-Élysées. It was calm, there was nothing moving, was quiet. And suddenly there was a gale. And in this wind and gale, I heard a voice. And the voice said, Christ has returned. And repeated it 3 times. He said, tell me, am I insane? Have I lost my mind? And May said, no, you have just regained it. You have just found it. And then she told him about the face, about Abdul Baha, about... And this young man was another instantaneous transformation. He completely changed all his plans. He had no desire anymore to travel in Europe to see any sights. He did not want to go anywhere. All he wanted to do was to go to Acre and to see Abdul Baha. And then the story of this young man is another one. But what happened to May? It is very fascinating. That day after Thomas Brakewell left her, she was so refreshed by this, she decided to go to the apartment of my mother's apartment, which was locked up, but the mail she was collecting. She went to collect the mail. This is now the same day. She went to collect the mail from the concierge there, and there was a cable from Abu Baha. She opened the cable. All it says, you may leave Paris now. It is really one of the greatest mysteries that we have in the history of our faith. That day, she was so overjoyed. She went back to gathered her things, and by next morning she was on a train and she went to her mother. And it's very interesting what happened to the mother. When she arrived, she told her mother the whole story of the whole month until it reached the end of it and the cable of Abdul Baha that she showed her mother. And her mother burst into tears. And she said, you truly have the wisest master in the world. You have a wonderful master. And from that day, this mother became really a devotee of Abu Baha. She was not a believer for many years, and she became a believer before her death, when she was very ill, and that the only thing that her daughter could do for her, because in those days, people who had cancers, there was no way of reducing the pain, and she was in great pain. And she would ask her daughter to come and pray for her. And May would put her hand over her bleeding chest and pray, and it would calm her down. And she died as a believer. But this story of beginning of the life of May was such a wonderful thing. This young woman was completely transferred. Now, another crisis of her life, again in Paris during this last year, was when she met her future husband, who was a young man, who had come to study, was a friend of her brother, and she was very attracted to him. But she had made up her mind that Abdul Baha had told her that she should stay in Paris and serve the cause, so she's not going to marry, she's not going to do anything. Eventually, her mother wrote a letter to Abdul Baha. She said, well, I don't want to interfere, but I want you to know what is happening to my daughter. She has this very fine young man, but she's not going to marry unless you tell her to, because she won't. And Abdul Baha sent a message to May and said that she should marry and go to Canada with her husband. And that's how in 1902 she left Paris and then she went to Canada. Now, the second part of her life in Canada was really as brilliant and as historic as what it was in Paris. Because with her, she took this love of Abdu'l-Bahá. And to the end of her life, this was the power within her. And Abdu'l-Bahá said that whoever meets Mae Maxwell, they receive from her the love of God. She had this talent of giving what was in her soul to other people. When she went to Canada, everything was strange. You know, for a person who was a city person, of a very mundane person, very cultured person and everything, Montreal of those days apparently was very provincial, and they were from a small group community of Scottish Presbyterian, the family of Mr. Maxwell. They were not French Canadian. First of all, Ruhi Khanum said her mother told her that when their boat docked in St. Lawrence and the workers came to take their luggage down, she listened, and she turned to her husband. She said, "What language people in this country speak?" She couldn't even recognize the French of the laborers, you know, at the dock. So everything was very strange for her. She wanted so much to reach the French Canadian from the moment she arrived. But there was a tremendous barrier between the English and the French. The French were the second class citizens, so to speak, in Montreal. And all her life she worked towards breaking this barrier, to bringing in the French Canadians, to make friends. And she was able to do the first French Canadian who came to the face was through her. Now, her husband was not a Baha'i. This is another part of her life that I think it's a very good lesson for many of us. Her husband was not a Baha'i. He was a very wonderful, artistic man. He was a first-class architecture. They had a very good firm in Montreal. The family were prominent. The husband adored his wife and would allow her to do anything she wanted, but he wasn't interested. He was interested in his own profession. And one of the stories of Mrs. Maxwell at this time, Khanum often used to tell to the young people because she felt it was a lesson for us. She said her mother told her that once she was alone sitting with her husband in the library, and Mr. Maxwell said, "You know, May, I love you. You will be all the only woman in my life. I have no interest in anybody else. But you are, all your mind and attention is centered on your religion. And I have my own profession. We are drifting apart." And Mrs. Maxwell was very upset, and she loved this husband of hers. She did not want to lose him, and she thought a little bit, and then she said, "Look, before I married you, I told you that first thing in my life will always be my faith. After my faith, you come, but the first thing and the most important is my faith. I told you from the very beginning. Now, if you cannot go with me on this way, I have to go alone." And after a little while, Mr. Maxwell took her hand and he said, "I will go all the way with you." And she always felt that moment of strength in her life was the cause of making her husband a Baha'i. It's a very interesting thing. She did not weaken. She did not barter her faith for her marriage, so to speak. And that their life was a very united, very happy, very loving couple to the very end. But Mr. Maxwell was just the opposite of his wife. You know, she was always thinking of the faith, of teaching the faith, going, having meetings and this. Mr. Maxwell was busy with his own life. Until in 1909, they went on pilgrimage to see Abdu'l-Bahá. And one night at the dinner table, Mr. Maxwell said, "Abdu'l-Bahá, I have a question." He said, "Yes." He said, "My wife worships God through you. The Christians worship God through Jesus. But I worship God directly. Isn't that the right way?" Not so to speak. And Abdu'l-Bahá said, "Where is God?" And he gave this typical answer we always give, God is everywhere. And Abdu'l-Bahá said, "Everywhere is nowhere." This is a philosophical answer. Everywhere is nowhere. A place is just one point you put your finger on. When you say everywhere, you are worshiping God through your own imagination. Then he said, a savage who worships God in a tree or in a stone is closer to God than a person who says, "I worship God directly," because he is worshiping his own imagination. While the fellow who is worshiping a tree, at least the tree is created by God. There is a connection there. And this very, very logical answer of Abdu'l-Bahá changed Mr. Maxwell. And Khanum always said that her mother believed that the confirmation that came to him was at that dinner table. Then Mr. Maxwell, even to the end of his life, was a very quiet man. Ruhi Khanum used to say, "I always considered my mother a saint and my father a very good man." He said when they died, Shoghi Effendi called Mr. Maxwell a saint and the mother a martyr. So Khanum said, "I really recognize and saw the values and the personalities of my parents through the eyes of Shoghi Effendi." He recognized that heroism of a martyr in Mrs. Maxwell, and he recognized the beauty of a saint in Mr. Maxwell. Now, in that pilgrimage of 1909, something very important and you might say drastic happened in the family of the Maxwells. One day, Mrs. Maxwell was holding one of the babies, one of the grandchildren of Abdu'l-Bahá. The mother was there. And Abdu'l-Bahá came out and saw her and looked at her. And he said, "You like to have a child, don't you?" And Mrs. Maxwell said, "Oh, I love to have a child, Abdu'l-Bahá." Abdu'l-Bahá said, "I will pray for you if you promise that nothing will come between you and the service to the cause." And Mrs. Maxwell said, "Master, you know that nothing will ever come between me and service to this cause. No child, no husband, nothing." And Abdu'l-Bahá promised her that he would pray for her in the shrine of Baha'u'llah that God may give her a child, if it is his will. And Ruhi Khanum was born a year later. And that in her upbringing of this child, she never forgot the promise that she had given to Abdu'l-Bahá, that the cause was always first in her life, and it remained first to the end of her life. And she brought up this child with this concept that Baha'u'llah is first, is the priority in life. Everything else will come after him and around him. And this was the education that she gave to her daughter. And the end of her life is really a brilliant part of her life. When this only beloved child of hers became the wife of Shoghi Effendi, it was so much for her. She could not believe that, you know, that she has given this daughter to the guardian of the faith, that is in such a sublime position. And this was all the time in her, what can I do for Shoghi Effendi to express my gratitude for this honor that he has bestowed on me? And it was the time, I said I won't talk about epochs, but it was the time of the first seven-year plan that Shoghi Effendi wanted the American Baha'is to leave their homes and pioneer and travel to South America. So she had it in her heart that she must do this as an act of her gratitude to the cause. She was 70 years old. She had very weak heart. The doctors had told her, and she was all her life, she was an invalid. She asked if she could go to South America. And Shoghi Effendi wrote and said, it's meritorious, but you have to have the permission of your doctor and the consent of your husband. Don't do it without his consent. This is very interesting. This is a woman who would do anything for the faith, not with the consent of the husband at all. But here Shoghi Effendi said, you can go only if your doctor allows you to go and if your husband consent to your travel. And it took poor Mr. Maxwell many months before he could say yes. He loved his wife. He knew how weak she was. He did not want her to go alone. He could not leave his business to go with her. And it took her many months. And eventually, when a niece of Mrs. Maxwell offered to go with her, that Mr. Maxwell accepted to allow her to go on that trip. And she was beside herself. The letters that she wrote after she knew that she could go on that trip are so beautiful. To all her friends, she wrote the letter that now she's going to go to South America. Until then, she had sent many people on their mission to teaching and pioneering. She both materially she helped them and she encouraged them. But now her own turn had come. And she prepared and she went on that trip. And as you know, she arrived in Argentina, and the day after she arrived, she died of a heart attack. And that's why Shoghi Effendi called her a martyr. She was the first American martyr, Canadian martyr, in the continent of Americas until then. She was a very, very wonderful human being. Shoghi Effendi said that her grave in Argentina is going to be a point of spreading the cause all over that continent. She was one of these brilliant, brilliant drops of water who became an ocean. I have several of those, and I think my time is now finished. So for today, may Maxwell would suffice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Nakhchavani. We know that these hours in the afternoon with Mrs. Nakhchavani are very precious, because we all know that the storytelling is one of the most efficient instrument of education. So knowing these stories, not only to know some stories, but it could be a very effective instrument for self-education. So thank you so much for this. Now we have until 7 o'clock the study time. And in this hour, Mr. Nakhchivani expects that all of you can study, read and study the section of tomorrow, the section number 1 and the section number 2. So we'll see you at 8:30. Thank you so much.